Those of you who don't recall much about it, because we've been here quite a while since I was last up here talking, we'll discuss the details behind it and some of the background in a moment. So don't worry, don't sit there and reread all of 2 Samuel. Open up with a prayer if you don't mind. Almighty God, our Father in heaven, thank you for being a kind and generous God to our families and to our loved ones. We ask you to bless us today. Keep our hearts and eyes and ears open to your truth, that we prepare for what is right and what is good and teach our children accordingly. We ask you will keep us near to you and bind us close to your heart. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen. Amen. 2 Samuel, which it wouldn't hurt to read it again. It's not too terribly long. I'm not going to read the entire chapter. I'm going to start out instead in verse 15, because that's the second half of the chapter I want to focus upon. However, just for certain basic background, 2 Samuel chapter 24 starts out as David desiring to count the people. He's put upon him by, we can debate what spirit put upon him, makes no difference, to count the people. So he told all of his men, Joab in particular, and all the soldiers, to go count all the men. It took, I think it was 9 months to count. It was quite a few people. And there's discrepancies as far as the exact number. 2 Samuel has a smaller number recorded versus 1 Chronicles has a much larger number recorded. Bottom line, it's over 1 million people. And we had discussed at the time as to why the discrepancy, and most likely it was probably Joab's choice to do a discrepancy, because in this book it actually describes that Joab did not like what David told him to do, so he purposefully altered the numbers. Knowing that, clearly Joab was not going to give David his request of a correct count, because Joab knew it was highly against the Torah to do so. We know that much, because it actually declares that that was Joab's intention. He purposely did not count particular tribes and certain peoples in spite of what David had requested. So there's different numbers, conflicting numbers. We don't know which one's right. Makes no difference. The point is probably neither one of them are correct. Joab purposely didn't want them counted correctly. Good for him. He did what was good. As far as he was, I think he did what was good. But beyond that, one of David's prophets come to him and says, God knows what you've done. This was wrong. I'll give you three choices, to what the punishment should be. And David chose, of course, the third one, which was the shortest, technically speaking, 3 days long, to be given into the people, all of Israel, being given into the hands of God for 3 days, which means a death. God's going to go through the countryside and kill a whole bunch of people for 3 days. What purpose? Well, God pointed, you do not count without redeeming, and you do not have the authority to count unless I tell you to count. David did it without redeeming, and he didn't ask authority. He just did it anyway. Those leaders get punished through their people when they screw up. But something unique had happened during this process is that God was infinitely wise in the sequence of events that occurred during this 3 days of slaughter, that God selected a particular piece of land for himself. And we're going to reread, starting out in verse 15, regarding this particular slaughter that was occurring and the property or territory that was then God had selected for to build the temple of God. Starting in verse 15. So the Lord sent pestilence in Israel from the morning until a set time. There died for the people from Dan to Beersheba 70,000 men. With the angel stretched out his hand against Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented of the evil and told the angel who was destroying the people, enough, stay your hand. The angel of the Lord was at the threshing ford of Araunah the Jebusite. David said to the Lord, when he saw the angel who was striking down the people, behold, I have sinned, I have transgressed, but these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand be against me and my father's family. Gad, who was David's prophet, came to David on that day and said, go up, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. So David went up, as Gad had said, as the Lord had commanded. Araunah looked out and saw David, the king, and his servants coming across to him. Araunah went out and prostrated himself to the king with his face to the ground. Araunah asked, why has my lord the king come to his servant? And David replied, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, so that the pestilence may cease from the people. But Araunah said to David, let my lord the king take and offer whatever is proper in his eyes. See, the cattle are available for elevation offerings, and the threshing tools influence of the cattle are available for firewood. Aruna the king gave it to the king. Aruna said to the king, "May the Lord your God accept your offerings." The king told Aruna, "No, I shall purchase it from you for a price, and I shall not offer to the Lord my God free elevation offerings." So David brought the threshing floor and the cattle, or bought the threshing floor and the cattle for 50 silvers or shekels, silver shekels. David built an altar there to the Lord, and he offered the elevation offerings, peace offerings to the Lord. And the Lord answered the prayers of the land. The pestilence was ceased from Israel. I wish to point out the reason I was talking about this particular chapter, recovering it again, is due with the vision that David is seeing regarding this particular angel. This account is recorded slightly differently in 1 Chronicles 21. 1 Chronicles chapter 21. Starting out in verse 14. It's 1 Chronicles 21. The Lord sent a plague upon Israel. 70,000 men of Israel fell. The God sent an angel to Jerusalem to destroy it. Now as he was destroying, the Lord looked and relented to the disaster. And said the angel who was destroying, "It is enough. Now restrain your hand." And the angel of the Lord stood by the threshing floor of the Ornan Jebusite. Then David lifted his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord standing between the earth and heaven, having in his hand a drawn sword stretched out over Jerusalem. So David the elders, clothed in sackcloth, fell on their faces, and David said to God, "Was it not I who commanded the people to be numbered? I am the one who has sinned and done evil, but these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand, I pray, O Lord, my God, be against me and my father's house, but not against your people, that they should be plagued." Then the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to go to David and say, tell David to go and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So David went in the word of the God and which he had spoken in the name of the Lord. Now Ornan turned and saw the angel and his four sons who were with him and hid themselves. But Ornan continued threshing wheat. Then David came to Ornan, and Ornan looked and saw David. And he went out from the threshing floor and bowed down to David with his face to the ground. And then David said to Ornan, "Grant me the place of this threshing floor, that I may build an altar on it to the Lord. You shall grant it to me for the full price, that the plague may be withdrawn from the people." And Ornan said to David, "Take it to yourself. Let my lord the king do what is good in his eyes. Look, I also give you the oxen for burnt offerings, the threshing instruments for wood, and the wheat for the grain offering. I give it all." The king said to Ornan, "No, but I will surely buy it for the full price, for I will not take what is yours for the Lord, nor burnt offerings which costs me nothing." So David gave Ornan 600 shekels of gold by weight for the place. David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings and called the Lord, and he answered him from heaven by fire on the altar of the burnt offering. The Lord commanded the angel, and he returned his sword to his sheath. At that time, when David saw the Lord had answered him on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, he sacrificed there. For the tabernacle of the Lord and the altar of the burnt offering which Moses had made in the wilderness were at the time in the high place of Gibeon. But David could not go before to inquire of the Lord, for he was afraid of the sword of the angel of the Lord. So the two records, which I've read them 2 months ago when we had discussed this briefly, regarding what had happened and what was going on, and we had discussed that the vision that David is seeing clearly is seen not only by him, but others as well, I think Ornan's sons hid themselves. It was debatable whether they hid themselves with the angel or not, but either way, the angel, the vision itself, which is what we had talked about, the angel had purposefully stopped at this place prior to anything telling him to stop other than God himself. So God told the angel, "Stop here. Don't go any further. We're not going to take Jerusalem yet. We're not going to conquer and slaughter Jerusalem at this point. Just stop." And the angel stopped and waited. Of course, David had to then, when he saw the angel had waited at this particular place, he, as according to the Gad had instructed him, went to that place, built an altar, and of course sacrificed to God. And the angel put his sword away, and God said, "Done." There are a few minor details which we had just discussed before. In 2 Samuel, it records David spending, I believe, 50 shekels of silver for the oxen. And in 1 Chronicles, it records 600 shekels of gold. Chronicles records the price of the place, the land, that David purchased. 2 Samuel records the oxen and the instruments used to build the altar. Two different price tags, two different things that David had to purchase. So bottom line, this piece of land that God selected to the angel to stop, means do not shed blood here, was worth 600 shekels of gold at the time of David's life, or when he purchased it. Which we had also discussed at the time, 2 months ago, when we talked about this, that this particular property, this piece of land, was at the north end of Jerusalem, right on the south slope of Mount Moriah, which today is where the Temple Mount stands. This was the purchase of where the temple of God was going to be placed. This is God saying, the angel will not shed blood on my land. This is my home. The God stops the angel right here. You don't get to kill anybody. David buys the land, offers animals only. They build a temple under Solomon. It took him 7 years to build it. And that is God's house. God selected the place. And this is how he selected it. No one else selected it prior to this. Granted, people may argue, which I'm sure they're absolutely right in many ways, that Abraham sacrificed, or attempted, almost sacrificed Isaac on a mountain, which says the Lord, place the Lord provides, which is most likely, but not guaranteed, this particular one. Because it said God would select the place. God would choose the mountain. And it doesn't appear it was the mountain of Moses. For Sinai, so it was probably most likely this particular place. Because it also corresponds to the place where Messiah was killed. Not that he was killed in a temple, but he was killed in this same city, the same town, the same area. So there's a lot of things that God purposely tied himself to this town, to this spot, and to where this temple was going to be laid. The ground itself, God selected, this is holy ground, nobody else gets to choose it. No one dies here by my hand or by yours. This is mine, leave it alone. I'm going to discuss the entire history of Jerusalem as all the kings built and rebuilt and built up and grew Jerusalem and the territory that was now established. We do not know when this event occurred in David's life. Just because 2 Samuel records it here in the sequence of Samuel does not mean that's the timing. Chronologically, God doesn't care about chronology. It doesn't matter. The point is event topics. The reason 2 Samuel 24 is at this place, instead of where it may or may not have been somewhere else during David's life, most likely a little bit earlier, because this is going to lead straight into Solomon builds the temple. It's a perfect. David buys land, Solomon builds the temple. That's the sequence that God wants us to understand and follow. At this particular event, David makes reference to a place of God's home that David selects when David's fleeing Absalom chapters earlier. Makes reference to this location. Well, if that's the case, that happened in chapter 21 and 19 and 18 and such. This is chapter 24. How would David reference a place that hasn't been purchased yet, hasn't been identified by God? Most likely the place had already been identified by God, and David already had to purchase the property and already had been making provisions to build the temple earlier in his life. But our books record it here, because chronology doesn't matter to God. It is events. It is the storyline, and it is the thematic ties he wants us to understand and follow. This is important now in the story. It wasn't important before, when it may or may not have occurred. Makes no difference. Now is what I want you to study it, because that's where it's placed. The purpose why I'm covering this again is to talk about the angel. Because we had talked about all this already. We talked about most of this chapter in the past. The angel himself, however, I didn't talk about all that much. Because as you notice, though we did not reread it this time, in the first part of this chapter, it did not disclose why God wanted this whole scenario to occur. David was inspired to count the people. Well, who inspired him? Possibly. One book says God did it. The other book says Satan did it. Well, which one did it? We don't know.
An adversary
against whom? Against God or against? It's against David. Can God be an adversary against you as a flesh and blood human being? Oh, you better believe he can. He's an adversary against all of us when we do something that we shouldn't be doing. And he's also an adversary against the people of Israel when they're doing something they're not supposed to be doing. If you recall, when Moses brought people out of Egypt, how many times was God's hand the one that ended up killing people?
A lot of times.
A lot of times. Why? Isn't he a compassionate, loving God that loves everybody, wants everybody to live forever? Of course. But when you screw up, what happens? Punishment has to occur. He can't say, oh, well, you know what? You make mistakes and it's all good. Well, God doesn't work that way. So I have rules. There are regulations. There are patterns you must obey. If you choose to go outside them, expect a consequence. If you stay within them, your consequences should be clean and be fair. You go outside, there are payments to be had. Well, I'm bringing this particular angel up because it seems to be this angel was responsible for the vast majority of God's hand against individuals and against people throughout the Bible. And the reason I'm bringing him up is because this angel's past and future events from 2 Samuel 24 will explain or open up more light as to what was going on during this moment in time when the counting occurred. Because this angel's done one thing over and over and over again throughout his history and throughout his existence, all for the exact same reason. If it's for the same reason, in all other accounts, he does this mass killing from here or there, wherever it may be, it's all accounted and attributed for one reason, for one cause, God brings this angel forth to do this work, then any past and current and present in 2 Samuel 24, and even our own personal future purposes, if this event that invokes God's use of this angel occurs again, and even in our own lives, expect a punishment accordingly. God doesn't change. His methods don't typically change for any reason unless you have a really, really good excuse. And the vast majority of us have a hard time coming with a good excuse. So we should talk about this particular angel. He has a pattern, and which means God has a pattern, which means God's telling us something by using this particular angel and giving David this vision. Did David need this vision to understand what he was supposed to do? Couldn't have the prophet Gad talk to David, okay, with David not seeing anything, not seeing any angel, not seeing any purpose behind it, other than God saying, okay, David, obviously you see people are dying. Go to this spot and build an altar. Would that have accomplished God's goal of purchasing a particular piece of property and building a temple? No. Why not?
Because it wouldn't have happened. God wouldn't have sent it if it hadn't been
needed. And if it hadn't been needed.
Yes.
God doesn't do things unless it needs to be done. Is God going to arbitrarily... let's say I need to pick up a pencil. Oh, God, could you just throw the pencil in my hand? Why not? I don't need the pencil to be brought to my hand. There's no reason for that. So why would God do it? There's no purpose. That gains nothing. If it's recorded there in particular in our Bibles, God really wanted us to read it and understand what's going on. Because it explains and expounds more of what God thinks and his past, present, and future actions. This particular angel, he's known as the Destroyer, is actually what his name is. Coincidentally, you might recall that name. It happens, shows up a couple of times. Sodom and Gomorrah, yeah. I'm going to discuss every example he shows up, but I'm discussing some of the key ones which should bring to your attention. I wrote up here a few chapters scattered throughout your Bible that discusses God's killing of particular groups of people caused by a certain event that they were or were not doing. So we'll start out in Exodus chapter 12. I'm not going to read everything here. I'm just going to give you the highlights of most of them. But 23 and 24, we already know Exodus. We know what happens in Exodus. So what angel can you possibly think I'm thinking of when I'm discussing Exodus chapter 12? That would be the death angel that happens and attacks Egypt and kills the firstborn. I'm bringing him up because it points out, though here it says the Lord in that does all this, in for New Testament, in First Chronicles, I believe, no, sorry, Chronicles, Corinthians, it points out the angel of the Lord did this, not the Lord himself. So we're not pretending that God the Father came down and killed people. He sent an angel to go do it. Makes perfect sense. That's what he normally has always done. So in chapter 12, it points out, and starting just in verse 23, and we'll jump to 29 as well, for the Lord will pass through and strike the Egyptians. When he sees the blood and the lintel of the doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you. Note, this is where he's titled the Destroyer. This is where the name or description, descriptive name. This is not a proper name. It is a descriptive name. There's two different things. The destroyer in your house will strike you. Of course, 29 actually records when he actually does it. And then it came to pass at midnight, The Lord struck the firstborn in the land of Egypt, the firstborn of Pharaoh was set on his throne, the firstborn of the captive, the dungeon, the firstborn of all livestock. Why was the angel of the Lord sent to do this to Egypt? What was the reason God did this? Was he bored one day? Yeah, I just have nothing else to do. I feel like killing people. What was Egypt? What had Egypt done up to this point? Overall, we're not saying every single practice, but overall, what had Egypt and Pharaoh done that deserved or required a payment in this type of fashion? Just an overall idea. You have a point?
Pharaoh just kept hardening his heart. This is the only thing that would loosen him up or soften him would be
hardened. I'm going to alter that word just slightly, which is equally the same word. He had a defiant heart. We're going to defiant. I don't know how it's spelled defiant. Forgive me. I'm sure I probably spelled it right. a defiant heart. It was defiance. Egypt had been defiant for the past 9 plagues prior. Pharaoh in particular had been defiant. Egypt themselves had even tried to coax Pharaoh, hey, knock it off a few times. But even then, a few of them were also equally defiant. Works in every scenario. But in Numbers, Exodus obviously contains on a few examples where Israel themselves are defiant. We won't discuss all of them. We'll just to get a few of the highlights. Most of them are written there on my little marker board. But jump to Numbers 12. Or sorry, Numbers 11. Actually, the whole chapter. Okay, I'll do parts of the chapter. Study it in verse 1. When the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, his anger was aroused. So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. The people cried out to Moses, and when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. He called the name of the place the Taberah, because the fire of the Lord had burned among them. What was the cause, in the first part of Numbers 11, of God's punishment through death to do this? Complaining, right? So complaints. I'm going to abbreviate to, because I don't have a whole lot of room to write. Continuing on in the same chapter, of course. People start complaining about food or lack thereof food. So, oh yeah, we didn't have enough food and whatnot. We're going to jump straight to verse 31. So people are continuing to complain and complain. In verse 31, it says, now a wind, this is for providing food. For a wind came out from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near the camp. About a day's journey on this side, about a day's journey on the other side. All around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground. The people stayed up all night, all the day, sorry, and that night, and the next day, and gathered the quail. He who had least gathered the least, gathered 10 omers. They spread them out for themselves all around the camp. But while the meat was still between their teeth, the Lord, before it was being chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. So he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, because they were buried there, the people who had yielded to craving. From Kibroth Hattaavah, the people moved on to other places. The purpose for God slaughtering these people on the tail end of chapter 11 was what? Why did he kill them with the quail? Well, what were they doing that said that he had to send quail? They were complaining. We don't have enough food. You didn't give us enough of this stuff, Moses. You're out here in the desert. We're all going to die. So they were complaining before. At the beginning of the chapter, which God killed a bunch of them, they complained. At the end of the chapter, God still kills a whole bunch of them. You can read the whole chapter, which it continues on the same process.
In the beginning, right?
What was that?
This is just in the very beginning.
Yes. Well, as they're traveling about, it doesn't end here in Numbers. It continues on. There's quite a few places that God winds up having to correct them. Numbers, let's see here, 14. Investigation of the Promised Land. I'm not going to read all of this, but you have the general idea. A whole bunch of guys were selected to go to the Promised Land and investigate. They came back with a bad report. This jumping straight to, verse 30. Caleb required the people for the most, said, "Let us go up at once, take possession, for we are well to overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against these people, for they are stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land, which they had spied out, saying, "The land is through which we have gone as spies, the land that devours its inhabitants and all the people who saw it, and the men a great stature. There we saw giants, the descendants of Anak, that came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, so we were in their sight." Let's see here. Then verse chapter 14. Sorry, that was the first start of chapter 13 I just had read. Chapter 14 moves on. All the children of Israel lifted up their voice and cried to the people, wept at night. The children of Israel murmured against Moses. What's murmuring? That's known as complaining. The congregation said to him, "If only we had died in Egypt, or if only we had died in the wilderness, why has the Lord brought us this land to fall by the sword? Our wives, our children become victims." They said to one another, "Let's return, choose up the leader and return to Egypt." And Moses and Aaron fell on their face before the assembly of the children of God, and Joshua, son of Nun, Caleb, who were among them, spied the land before they tore their clothes. They spoke to the congregation, saying, "The land we brought through is good, it's great, wonderful, let's go in, it's not a problem." Skip, jump on down a little bit further. Verse 20. So the Lord responds to their complaining. This is his response. "I have pardoned you according to your word." I missed something. I don't think I just lost my verse. Truly lived in this earth. Oh, there it is. Verse 36. I apologize. The men whom Moses sent out to spy the land, what did God do to them? Verse 36. Those who returned made the congregation murmur against him by bringing a bad report. Those very men brought the report. They died with a plague before the Lord. He sent a plague and killed them all. So Joshua and Nun and Caleb were the ones who made alive, who went out to spy the land. So in Numbers 14, the people who went through to spy the land, what was their end result, those who complained? They died. So more complainers. We're going to go through all these. Number 16, general idea, guess what? Korah is a complainer. What happens to him and all the men who are with him? They die. So number 16, Korah dies from they complain. Numbers 21. What happens in Numbers 21? Jump ahead a little bit. People die. Why? In Numbers 21, it's the serpents. This is the people complain, and God sends the serpents out to sit there and bite them all. They have to look up at the snake to survive. But not the snake. It's just serpents in general. They complain, and God kills them. Do you see a pattern? What's the pattern that you see? Complain against God, and you usually end up dead. Well, right. They're testing him. But the people who end up testing, the ones who didn't die.
Yeah.
Does God like complainers? I would say definitely not. I see a whole lot of dead people. Yeah, I'd say no, he doesn't like complainers. So I have a question for you. What was the source of their complaining? Why would you, what makes you complain? What makes me complain?
Lack of trust.
Lack of trust. Lack of following God, even though it scares you. I'm going to use another word for lack of trust, though it's the same principle. It's the same thing that Pharaoh did. It's defiance. The basics. Basic root of lack of trusting someone and saying, God says, go do this. And I say, I don't want to do that. This is too scary for me. Did I just defy God who just said, go do that? Well, tactically, I did. Yes.
Back in Exodus 12, that word that's referred to as harden means to heavy or deadened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used elsewhere to talk about someone who's insensitive. And when you see those times when it came in, he had gone back to Moses and said, "Oh, please, you know, take this away." You know, his response was natural because, you know, realized, "Oh, look,
this hurts.
You know, I'm up against a much bigger power that I'm helpless against. I need to give in."
Right.
But then God renders his heart insensitive to the obvious. So he's not like trusting reality anymore, and now he's just saying, "Hey, you know, he thinks now he's on top of the situation.
I've regained control."
Yeah.
Yes, Tammy.
The one thing that comes to my mind that you don't have mentioned in the list is, at least not directly, is those two sons of Aaron who brought the strange fire.
Right.
They weren't complaining per se. They weren't whining and kvetching.
But they did
something
they knew
was wrong. Defiance.
Exactly.
They had their own way.
You're absolutely right. There's numerous examples of the exact same thing. The basis of your not following God's law, not following what he instructs you to go do, is a defiant action, whether it's caused by your personal fear, whether it's caused by your personal non-trust. It makes no difference. You were saying to God, "No." That's what you're doing. You're saying no. Yes, Anne.
The obvious question is that the unbeliever would ask you, "Well, if God hardened his heart, then how is the guy guilty of anything at all? Because God is the one who hardened your heart. So what is that all about?"
Right. So that's getting off topic of my topic today. I did bring this up to Gary a number of years ago, which as far as still makes sense in my personal head. It's all I can really tell them. So when you are backed up against a corner, let's say there's the whole world's coming down against you, and then you do is wrong, you have a choice of die or not die. What is your instinctive reaction? You know the principle of, have you backed up a wild animal in a corner? What does it do? Fight or flight. It lashes out. When you've backed up, when I get backed up, or somebody else gets backed up into a corner, I have no choice, I go down to a root, basic instinct of fight or flight. That's what I do. Every human's going to do that. Some will fight, and some will just lay down and quit. They die. Whatever the choice is, those are the only two options you have. If you are brought down to that level, all your pomp and circumstance has been stripped of you. You are down the bottom end. What are you made of? What was Pharaoh made of? Arrogance. So did God harden him, or did God reveal him? To me, that's a revealing. God uproots the base of who Pharaoh is. Yeah, created or exposed what he was. God exposed it. Is it God's fault that he exposed who Pharaoh really was? Well, no, it's not God's fault. But Pharaoh was exposed. His heart was exposed of who he really was, which was an utter defiant, "I am God, you're not."
If you're backed against the wall, then...
By God...
Okay, by God, say in our circumstance or whatever, then the idea is to just fall on your knees and say, "Lord, help me," and that would be the answer rather than fight God.
It just so happens it plays in so well. Isaiah chapter 9, there's a statement in there that God corrects the people, and he says, I've struck you, and because you have not returned to the one who struck you, I will strike you more. God put forth the strike. I have slapped you across the face. And because you have not now come to me, the one who slapped you, I'm going to slap you harder. So when God backs you against the wall, what's your proper response? Open your arms up and say, "Take me back." Run to the one who slaps you. I know it sounds bizarre, but when you're a child, a little child, you slap your child's hand. They got something, did something wrong, whatever it's supposed to be. They slap the hand, you get in trouble. What happens? They cry and they want a hug. Who doesn't? That's exactly what God would love for us to do. "Oh, I'm so sorry. God, give me a hug. Tell me you still love me." That's a natural human instinct. We know it's natural human because our children, who have no inhibitions about, you know, societal issues, do it. It's built into us. So what's God expecting when he slaps you and smacks you against the wall because you did something really stupid? He expects you to open your arms up and says, "God, show me you still love me."
So, but so then my idea of thinking, okay, I'm the child of, I'll make it short. I'm child of a battered mother. So my mother was against the wall, you know, and dad was hitting. So, you know, where I would think as a kid, you know, mom hit back or something, you know.
Defend oneself, right.
You know, so that was my vision of it, you see. But now if you look at it from the child's point of view, being an innocent child, and their daddy just gave them, you know, slap against the
whatever,
hand because
yeah. they
picked up fire or some
right.
stupid
some
thing, you know,
foolish
did
thing.
Some foolish thing. So then, yes, they want to be hugged right away.
Yeah.
So I had to change my own vision of what I saw, you know, as a child.
Yeah. What happens, even although this is a very horrific example, but what happens if your mother fights back? Usually, not everybody, but usually, according to what I've been read and told, the attacker attacks harder.
Yeah.
It's a stronger response. You respond back to fight back or defend, the response against you is even harder.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we should all bow and cower to people who are abusing us. It's the act of response and reaction that goes back and forth to each other. And the same principle, if I sit there and slap my son's behind because they're wrong, he goes and yells at me for it, guess what? I slap him harder. You don't get to yell at me because you got in trouble. It's your own fault. That same principle. You don't react or defend yourself in that fashion. It does not gain you anything. It just gains a harsher response to you. Yes.
Well, you know, I think that what she brought up was very important because that is one of the key examples of equivocation, meaning that you are comparing, oh, God is violent and, you know, the adversary, evil powers are violent too, so they're both bad. No, because you're taking out motive or reason out of this. You know, the violence is not the same. One is directed out of love. You're going down the wrong path.
Right.
You need to come back. There
right.
is a good way that is the right way to go. The other is just seeking power.
Right.
And beating down forces that oppose.
Right. He's absolutely right. And I'm not arguing that, you know, a lady or a person, a human, in that situation should then just sit there and take it and move on. No. The point is that if you respond a particular way to an event that happens to you, an alternate event comes against you even harder. In someone's circumstance, that may be that case, the only advice I would have, okay, wait until the event has passed and get out. Do not return, whatever your case, get out. Do not fight during the moment, wait till the moment has passed, then flee. Take anything you possibly can get and flee. Never return, never be found again. That is the only proper response you would do in an instant negative power struggle type situation. We're not discussing that with God, you can't flee from him. And he's not doing anything out of just his own pure will of destruction. He's doing it because you did something you shouldn't have done to start with and you know it. Anyway, sorry, that's just way off topic. But 2 Kings is an example. Let's see here. I'm going to discuss all 2 Kings chapter 19. It has to do with an army had come against God's people and they were defiant. The army was. There was a commander of the army. Oh, I forgot his name. Yeah, it was here. I forgot the Sennacherib was the other one. The one before him. No, it was him. Yeah, Sennacherib's here. He's the king. But there's a commander. I can't think of the commander's name. I forgot it. Anyway, the commander who attempts or shows up first says very flippant words against Israel. You are worthless. Your God is nothing. You're pathetic. You're all going to die. We're going to kill you. And the people of Israel said, can you not speak in our language, please? Because there are people who understand it. We'll speak. We understand yours. We don't want you to hear. We don't want them to understand what you just told us. You might dishearten them. And he said, no, I'm not going to speak in my language. Speak in yours so that everybody hears. They all know you're all going to die. What is that an act of? Of defiance. As an act of, I'm greater than you. Now, God brought this army up.
And they were bigger. Stronger.
They were bigger and stronger, but God brought the army up. They weren't doing anything technically wrong, per se. God raised the army up to correct. But they crossed a very serious line. They put themselves far higher than God. What was God's response?
Wiped them out.
In verse 35, chapter 19, this is God's response to this particular army of the Assyrians. Sennacherib's army. It came to pass on a certain night that the angel of the Lord went out and killed the camp of the Assyrians, 185,000 men. And when the people arose early in the morning, there were corpses, all dead. So King Sennacherib of Syria departed, went away, and returned home and remained at Nineveh. Now it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the temple of Nisroch, his god, that his sons Adramelech and Sharezer struck him down with the sword, and he escaped in the land of Arat. Then Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place. The act of defiance, what's God's typical response? Death. We got that already. You're defying or complaining. Complaining is defying the same thing as far as God's concerned, because either way, you're not doing what God wanted you to do. His response is to kill you. I have a question for you. What was the reason then of God wanting Israel punished when David did the counting? Now, on the surface it says, well, because David counted. Now, wait a minute. If David's counting was the sole reason, and there was no other purpose, it seems a bit heavy-handed.
Yeah.
It seems a bit heavy-handed. Could it be, which is just a hypothesis here, since the particular angel is spoken of or referenced in David, by the way, those of you who wish to point to read it yourself, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, it points out, this is for 1-13, the grumblers against God, or people who complain and defy against God, God kills by the angel, the destroying angel. That's what it instructs. It says the people of Egypt, they came out of Egypt, that's what God did. He killed them by the destroying angel. Now this example here with Sennacherib, clearly, the angel of the Lord went out, which is the destroying angel, went out and killed the people of Sennacherib's army. The act of God using this particular angel to do something appears to be an act based upon them being complainers and defiers. So it results in God killing them in a particular fashion using a particular angel. So the act this angel has done in David's time, is it solely the responsibility and solely the cause of David's counting? Or is there an underlying problem in all of Israel, too? There's most likely an underlying problem in Israel. Right. There's probably more to it than just the surface. It's mainly the straw that broke the camel's back type of process, the belief. Was the straw the cause of it? Well, of course not. It was the abundance of all the pressure that came upon it that caused the breaking. It was the straw was the last thing. Any type of group does this. The reason I bring this up is because in Revelations, this angel has another task. He's used, there's other places he's used too. I've got, I don't think we recorded them all there, but there's a few places that he's used. But in Revelations, angel, which he's named again, same name, nothing different, same old angel, does the same old thing. Revelations 9, he has a job to do. He's brought yet once again, which is an event that has not happened in our personal lives yet, but theoretically it should someday. Chapter 9 of Revelation points out, then the fifth angel sounded, I saw a star fall from heaven to the earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit, which is also known as the grave. He opened the bottomless pit, and smoke rose out, like the smoke of a great furnace. The sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given the power as the scorpions of the earth have power. The command not to harm the grass, the earth, or any green thing, or any green tree, but only those men who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days, men will seek death and not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. And the shape of the locusts is like the horses prepared for battle. On their heads a crown, something of gold, and their faces were like faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like lions' teeth. And they had breastplates like breastplates of iron, sound of their wings like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. They had tails of scorpions, their stings were in their tails, the powers to hurt them for 5 months. And they had as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in the Greek, he has the name Apollyon. One woe is past, behold, two more are coming after these things. The two words, Apollyon, of course, means destroyer, destruction, someone who destroys something. What was the angel called in all of these other instances? The destroyer. So, okay, so the Greek word Apollyon, which means destroyer, and this angel here is called destroyer. Is it possible the same, not the spirit necessarily, but the task, the assigned task that God's using, he used it here for all one particular reason, defiance or complaining, all the way through. What's he using it here for? Torments. Who? Why? Those that defy. He uses it again for one purpose, the defiance. Now, it's a pattern, it's a cycle. God reuses the same example over and over and over again. When you see these things, there's one cause that brings it forth. Defiance. I point out Abaddon. Abaddon is a Hebrew word. It means nothing more than he who has the door, the place where there's a fish hook. The one is in charge of, he is the door is in charge of, the place or the something where you have a fish and a hook. What do you do with a fish hook? You catch fish out of where? Water. What's water in Hebrew? The same principle. Abyss. The grave. The guy who could open the door to the grave. Abaddon just means the guy who opens the door to the grave. Well, that's what he says out here. He given him the key to the bottomless pit. He's the guy who opens the door to the grave. It's a descriptive title, not a physical name. So, Abaddon, Apollyon, they pointed, Abaddon means to destroy. It actually does not mean destroyer. It means the guy who has the door to the grave, and he is able to open it or pick it up. That's all the word means. Nothing fancy about it. It's pretty basic and simple. But Apollyon, the destroyer, is more descriptive on the biblical text as far as in the Torah, what it discusses, what this entity's name is. So God's using this character, using this entity in repeated examples, the case of defiance and complaining against God, which is a form of defiance. That's what I wanted to talk to you about, so what this guy was doing here and what his purpose was and what God was using him for, what God still has, and if I still will use him for. The same thing. Defiance. Defiance brings forth destruction and death. Pretty basic, pretty simple. God's repetitive. He does it over and over and over again until we finally get the picture. Yes, Ali, you had your hand up there?
So back to David, he's afraid of the guy that can kill him.
Yeah, he's afraid of the guy who has a sword.
Line. Because he was defiant.
He knew he defied. David was defiant. He had counseled the people. It was one of the many things he did. Exactly, and they told him not to, and he did it anyway. So clearly there was obviously a defiance upon David's part, obviously. That's explicitly given. My point was, if that was the sole reason why it was all of Israel, 70,000 men, killed, there was most likely, because God, I believe, is a very compassionate God. If you make one mistake and have done nothing else wrong, is he going to slaughter you for that mistake? More often, he says, I will be compassionate, and I will have mercy, and I will wait. As your mistakes build, and build, and build, and keep adding on to each other, what does he finally do? You know what? I can't wait any longer. I have to address some of these things. Now, we already know from previous readings prior to David, the people of Israel were pretty corrupt. They had gone down a pretty rotten road regarding worshiping other gods, and Moloch worship and Baal worship at the time was still going on even during David's lifetime. They were still doing those things and had gone downhill from the time which Joshua had entered the land. They had gone downhill quite a ways. So this isn't as if, oh, it's completely out of the blue. God sits there and strikes you because they just, at this moment in time, they decided to do something bad. They have 400 years of bad things adding up and them not being punished fully for them. Like the United States.
Not like a certain area. I mean, it would, like a whole group of people. What if there was like good people? It didn't matter?
It doesn't usually matter.
So
I know it sounds bad, but it truly doesn't
like
usually matter.
Like Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, but then Lot got out, remember?
Yeah.
But so
his wife didn't. She died.
She wasn't supposed to turn around, right?
Why? But she did anyway. Defiance. That's what happened.
Yeah,
she died.
Yeah.
No, for example, my personal belief, and you may hardly disagree with me on this, my personal belief, our events of 9/11 that had crumpled those towers, I believe God's hand was somehow involved in that. Now, if I believe that, I also know that there were probably some decent people that were killed along that process. Just statistical probability, there's likely to be somebody good that was killed. Does that mean that that person was not supposed to be killed? God made a mistake?
No, but it could change that family.
It could change anybody's life.
A lot of people
but
going to church.
What makes a bad event a tragedy is when something bad happens to somebody who is good. What makes a bad event justified is when something bad happens to somebody who's bad. That's a basic principle. We all believe that. We all understand that. If you're a good thing, you did something good and you got punished for it, that's not fair. Well, if you did something bad and you got punished for it, well, yeah, that's justified. That's what makes something a tragedy. Will we pay attention? Would I notice a non-tragedy? Of course not. How many people are executed in Texas for crimes, and just like, rightly so, and I do not know their names? I don't know how many hundreds they do per year. They're justified. I don't care. When a tornado strikes, do I know about it? Do I hear about it? That's a tragedy. Why? Because good people died too. Suffering happened. But that's what makes me notice it. 9/11 the exact same way. That's what I see. Oh, look. Oh, what happened? I start asking questions. If somebody, oh look, he killed 45 people, he was shot. Do I care what the questions are? No. Why did they shoot him earlier? He deserved killing before the 45 were dead. Clearly he wanted to die. I don't ask questions. That was justified. When something sad or tragic happens, I ask questions. I do soul searching, another way of wording it. Or look within inside ourselves or myself. Oh no, something has gone wrong. Something bad has happened, and it wasn't on bad people. Pay attention. God's probably trying to tell you something. Make sense?
Yes, what you think about us not worrying about those people whose souls are dying and going to hell because you don't think about it all day.
Right.
We're not worried about Mrs. Jones, who may be not even saved.
We don't even care. It's a non-entity to us. It doesn't bother us anymore. So thank you for sitting with me and dealing with this. I just wanted to get this angel off my plate to talk about, because I've got other things to discuss the next time I'm up here. Any questions? Hopefully I answered them all reasonably well. Just something to think about. Just consider what God does and his uses of tools.
No, that's Gabriel. Gabriel is an angel.
Different angels have different tasks.
Different tasks. Because he was one time fighting and he couldn't come to Daniel, I think.
Right. Right. That's Gabriel and right. The principalities of the air are over the Medes and Persians at the time. Persians.
What an angel of God does, he obeys.
Right.
But I mean, there's only so many names that he named, right?
There's only a few.
He's got leads of them, but there's only particular names he tells us.
Right. Well, there's no reason. If I told you all the names, the angels that were surrounding you, what would you do? You'd probably start talking to them. Do you want to start talking to the angels instead of talking to God?
No.
Not a good idea. So it's best for you to not know who, how many, or what their names are who are around you.
Yeah, I already see enough as it is.
Honestly, we worship things very easily.
Oh, yeah.
If you start surrounding us with deities, that we, ooh, look. What do? That's what we do. It's human instinct. That's what we do. Wow, you're stronger than me. Ooh.
We talk.
You know, that's really interesting that we don't pay attention unless it's a tragedy. The Zimmerman,
right.
Kayvon thing, somebody got hurt without justice. We don't know which one it was. So a lot of sides are taken without even knowing
right.
the facts. But that's why it became publicity.
It's a problem.
Somebody was hurt that shouldn't have been.
Right.
It was
an unnecessary, unjustified scenario. Whoever the scenario was,
somebody,
makes a difference.
Somebody started
I believe,
something that shouldn't happen.
Cosby had once mentioned regarding this topic that had Zimmerman not had a gun on him, both parties would have still been alive, and he probably would just watch the kid and drove behind him for a while until the kid went home.
Or he would be dead.
No, he would never have confronted him. He would have heard it. That was the point. That the tragedy to, and Kaji's point is that both parties, neither one should have died, and neither one, this scenario itself, should not have occurred. No. We're not discussing that. We're not discussing the law. So the scenario itself, neither man should have been hurt, should have died. They both weren't doing anything wrong. Neither of them did anything wrong. So why did they both? One of them got hurt and one died. For whatever reason, you can argue about during the fight, who cares? The point is, one man's dead who didn't do anything wrong up to that point of the fight. And then a man was injured, of course, killed him, who also didn't do anything wrong until the fight. The whole thing was a tragedy. What has happened? Our whole nation got caught up and said, look at this tragedy. Someone was hurt for no reason. Someone died for no reason. It wasn't that either one was out there a mass murderer. No one was a mass rapist. No one was sitting there stealing and breaking and burglarizing homes that we know of. We don't know anything of details behind it. Nobody justified or deserved injury or death. But a bad thing happened because it was a tragedy. That's the whole point behind tragedies. We look at them and say, oh, let's think about this. Observe why, who, how, all the details, and make sure that I don't get myself caught in this type of scenario.
It gets our attention.
You can take your side to whoever you think was guilty of whatever. I don't care. The whole story itself is the fact that it was a tragedy. Yes, Tammy, I need to close up here.
You know, I was just thinking about this to kind of conclude this, because I'm taking notes on everything. You know, the death of, whether it's the death of 70,000 people, we're talking about 9/11,
or
the death of 3,000 plus people and all this, is supposed to provoke soul searching among the survivors to repent.
Exactly.
But do we?
So frequently we don't. I have yet to find very many who ever have. That's the reason why God points out in prophecy, this is what I'm going to do to you. And then when you say, I don't care, I'm going to go do this. He's not saying... If we automatically said, oh, well, of course we care, of course we'll stop our ways, would he even bother recording the rest of the stuff he's going to do to you if you don't? Well, he already knows you'll do something right. He already knows you'll respond properly. Well, he knows we obviously won't respond properly. Thus, he has to record all the details of what he's going to do after us or to us when we say, forget you, God. Told to you. You can warn you can tell you can speak to you, and if you're not going to listen, you're not going to listen.